It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later in the program, we'll be talking about the role of race in the George Zimmerman trial.
But first, we're excited to be joined now by Chris Cluey. He's a football player, online activist, gaming enthusiast, and now we can add author to that list.
Chris's new book is Beautifully Unique Sparkle Ponies, on myths, morons, free speech, football, and assorted absurdities. It's a collection of essays and stories on everything from playing in the NFL to how to win the internet in 7 easy steps.
And Chris Cluey, welcome to Central Time.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's going well. So, you know, we want to get this out of the way right at the top. You played for the Minnesota Vikings for 8 years.
Boo.
We are here in Wisconsin. Should we be mad at you, or can we, you know, like, be friends now?
Well, see, the thing is that as the punter, I'm actually your favorite person to see on the field, because that means I'm giving your team the ball. So everyone can cheer for me.
All right. That's one way to read it. We'll go forward with that.
So, Chris, the first time I heard about you was when you wrote your letter to Emmett Burns, who is, a state senator or a state representative in Maryland. And it was a very interesting – I mean, it spun all over the web. Everybody read about it. Everybody was tweeting about it. It was really interesting. And I had the same reaction, apparently, that your dad did. So I want to talk a little bit about the original column itself, and then I want to talk about your dad's reaction and my reaction after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was it's funny because my dad's reaction was, hey, do you think you could have used less swear words or perhaps no swear words? And my response was that. Well, I enjoy using swear words because I happen to find them entertaining, and there are other people who find them entertaining. But the thing is that, and I actually wrote this in the book because I also printed the censored version of the letter that I put out. And what I said there was that no matter how many scatological mashups I had in my letter, the truth is that what Emmett Burns was saying in his letter was so much more vile, and that he was essentially telling someone that you do not have the right to speak. You do not have the right to be yourself. And to me, that is not something we should be condoning in our society.
And I have to say, and for people who aren't familiar with the letter, it is a letter, an open letter that you wrote to Emmett Burns, who was from Maryland. And Mr. Burns apparently had written a letter to the Baltimore Ravens, which are a football team, and one of their players had made some comment about same-sex marriage. And what Mr. Burns said was, the Ravens shouldn't let him speak. And you started talking about First Amendment rights and the Constitution, and all over the country people are saying, here's a football player who's talking about the Constitution with a giant question mark after that. I mean, how did that make you feel?
Well, it's funny because there actually are a lot of very smart people in the NFL. It's just you never really hear about them because they take care of business and then they go home to their families. And the ones you hear about are the guys who make mistakes, the guys who get arrested, the guys who do stupid stuff. So it paints the NFL with this broad brush that, you know, really isn't that accurate, but it's very hard to report on a guy not doing anything because that's not really news. That's, you know, that's just accepted behavior.
Well, you think there's something about athletics, you know, and the athletes. You're not supposed to have a voice in current events. You're just supposed to show up on the field, do your job, make Americans cheer and feel good. You're not supposed to voice political opinions.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because that's such a current modern day mindset, in that you look back at the history of athletes and sports in general, and there were many athletes who stood up and took a stand. I mean, you know, you talk about the Olympics in Berlin. You talk about Muhammad Ali, Jackie Robinson. There are so many cases in our past where sports figures have been positive role models for social change. And I think the problem is now is that we have the growing corporatization of sports, and that it is a huge business. And as a business, you have Michael Jordan's famous quote, even Republicans buy tennis shoes. And so the people who run it don't want to risk alienating anyone, which is really kind of a shame because there are certain stances that athletes can be hurt on.
Has it gotten you in trouble, do you think? I saw it suggested that your outspoken letter and your views are part of what let Minnesota, you know, show you the door a little bit. Do you think there's anything to that?
I honestly don't know because I'm not in the meetings with the coaches and the GMs. You know, I don't know what is said, what their rationale is. The only thing I can do is trust in my body of work that I've put together over the years, which is I've been the statistical leader for the Vikings in terms of punting, been the best they've ever had. So right now I'm just focused on making the team with Oakland and going out and proving I can still play at an NFL level.
So here's a question for you. You know, you've got this new book out, and you're talking about making the team for Oakland, and we wish you all the best with that. But you're clearly somebody who's interested in writing. You're clearly interested in thinking about a wide variety of things. You blog. You've got a book. So what are you? Are you a sports figure? Are you a writer? What, you know, do I need to stick you into some niche, or are you more than that?
Renaissance man.
I'm a human being. It's we're all complex people. We're all, you know, we have a whole bunch of different things that make us who we are. And that's one of the things I wanted to try and show with the book is that when you put a label on someone, no matter what that label is, whether it's a football player or gay or a sports announcer or a writer, you know, whatever that label is, it really doesn't account for everything else that goes into making that person who they are. So it really, people need to get past this idea because it's very lazy thinking to think that you can define someone in just one word or one phrase. And I think people need to understand that we are all complex creatures, and the sooner we realize that, the sooner we can get past this idea that people are only defined by one phrase, one word.
You know, it's got to be a great time to have that kind of thinking and have the opportunity to publish in so many places.
Yeah. It's been awesome. I mean, to me, the book was more, it wasn't something I'd ever really planned on doing. It was more, I had a bunch of publishers say, you should write a book. And I figured if the people in charge of writing books tell you you should write a book, then
write a
you
book.
Should probably write a book. So then when I wrote it, I didn't want it to be the standard football autobiography because that's what everyone does. I wanted it to be something different. And the topics I have in there are all things I feel strongly about. You know, they're things I've thought about, and really it's hopefully a snapshot into my mind. So buyer beware, but you can kind of see what's rattling around inside there while I'm thinking about things.
Well, one thing you talk about that's pretty fascinating for someone who's never been in that position is just what you're thinking about as you're waiting for your turn to go punt the ball. And there's some downtime involved there. Tell us about the stuff that goes through your head, what you're thinking about.
Yeah, so when you're out there punting, ideally you're not thinking about anything at all. You want to get kind of that zen state where you let your muscles take over and do the motion that you've practiced so many times before. But going into it, when you actually do think about it, there's so much that goes into just the simple act of catching and punting a football. And it's really only about a second and a half of action, but there's so many different things that go into it that when I wrote the piece, I was actually kind of surprised myself at, wow, that's a lot of different things that go into actually punting a football. That's kind of crazy to think about.
Well, run us through some of them. What is it that goes into it?
So you have to catch the snap first. So you're ready, balanced on the toes of your feet, or on the balls of your feet, waiting for the snap. You have to tune out the fact that there's eight people running at you trying to decapitate you. once the ball comes back to you, you have to make sure you catch it clean, grip it in your hands, find where the laces are at so you get a good drop, extend the ball out, make sure it drops clean so that you can hit it consistently with your foot, watch it all the way down. Hit it with your leg locked out so you impart the most force to the ball as possible. Follow through, make sure you follow through downfield. You're not falling back, so that way, again, you get more hang time and distance. And then you have to run down and cover, which is its own exciting adventure.
Wow. Okay, so, Gene, are you able to do that now that you've heard how it's done?
Well,
yeah, because I'm trying not to think about it.
I understand they've got an opening at Minnesota, right? So I could probably go do that.
Definitely. You make it sound like a kind of, you know, a Zen meditation where your body kind of takes over. And if you're in the zone, you're in the zone and you're not thinking that much.
Right, exactly. And that's the ideal goal is that you practice it so much so that when the game situation comes, you don't have to think about it. You just let your mind get out of the way, and you let your body react. And I think you see that with pretty much any, you know, person at the top of their game in sports is they will tell you, I'm not really thinking about what I'm doing. I'm acting, I'm moving, and my body knows what to do because I've trained it to know what to do.
Well, we're talking with Chris Cluey about his new book, Beautifully Unique Sparkle Ponies. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give us a ring at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
Yeah, we'd like to hear from you. We'll have more with Chris and with you right after this break. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Chris Cluey. And if you'd like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And Chris, one thing you've been pretty vocal about is your love of games. And it still seems like, you know, there might be a little bit of a stigma surrounding gamers and the whole geek culture. But, you know, as vocal gaming geeks ourselves here, we're sort of wondering, can you talk about embracing your inner geek?
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of video games, tabletop gaming, pen and paper role playing games. It's something I grew up with, and really, I think the thing is that you're seeing it a lot more mainstream now because kids are growing up in houses that have Xboxes, that have PlayStations. You know, a computer is not a frightening foreign object anymore. It's it's something you use, and so it's really. Everyone has hobbies. Everyone geeks out about something. It's just now video gaming, people understand that, yes, a lot of people do that, and it's okay to do.
And it is. And we go to phones right now, and Enya joins us from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I just was wondering, for Chris, what inspired the title of your book. It's really interesting.
Tell us.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, tell us about the Sparkle Pony concept.
Yeah, I get that question a lot. It's so when I originally came up with titles, the phrase that people really seemed to latch onto on the original letter was Lustful Sea Monsters and not Cyrus the Unsinkable Sea Serpent. It was a word I can't really say on public radio.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem. So when I was coming up with titles, I wanted to kind of pay homage to the phrase that everyone had really kind of grasped. And one of the censored versions I used was Beautifully Unique Sparkle Ponies. I was like, well, okay, that'll be perfect. Not only does it call back to the letter, but it's also really absurd. And the fact that, you know, bookstores are going to have to stock this in nonfiction is going to be amazing. So it was, I'm a big fan of the absurd, and I wanted to include that in the book.
And the fact that you are pictured sitting on what may or may not be a sparkle pony only adds to the mystique.
Yeah. And so a great story behind the cover photo is that photo shoot happened in the driveway of my house. So there was a carousel horse sitting on top of it, guy taking pictures, you know, they have the light box set up and everything. And our new neighbors are moving in next door. So, yeah, it was a very welcome to the neighborhood moment.
Well, I'm sorry I missed it. 800-642-1234 if you would like to join in. You know, you cover a lot of ground, a lot of topics in here. The Pope, the internet, you know, the kids, life lessons. When you're thinking about things to write, is this something that comes to you? Do you have topics that just appear magically? Are you organized about it? How does it work for you?
Generally just whatever pops into my head, something that I want to write about. I mean, even just listening to the news report, you guys did the headline news a couple minutes ago. I mean, there's three things right there that I could very easily write about. The fact that we're living in a society where we have a unmanned aircraft that can land on an aircraft carrier that will carry weapons and use them to bomb people in far off land. And that's just, yeah, sure, we accept it. And we have armed guards preventing people from getting a closer look at mining operations. Sure, yeah, we accept it. It's, you know, it's stuff like that as a society, we need to take a step back and say, is this the direction we want to go? Is this what we're really looking at? I mean, we have legislators pushing through laws that are limiting women's rights, what to do with their bodies. And people are like, okay, yeah, sure, we like it, whatever. And really, if you look at it historically, societies that do that, that allow themselves to get distracted by entertainment, that don't value education and science, those are societies that collapse, and it's just a matter of time.
Well, your book is a fun book. You cover a lot of fun ground, like Gene was just talking about, but you do devote serious attention to, you know, topics like you were just talking about. And there's a quote in there that stuck in my mind. You say that the only thing you have intolerance for is people who are not tolerant of others. And mm-hmm. that's something you take seriously.
Yeah, very seriously, because I majored in history and political science in college. And when you look back at the historical record, civilization has a 100% failure rate. There has never been a civilization that has withstood the test of time. You know, I think about 1,000 years, maybe 1,500 years for the Chinese dynasties. But the problem with these civilizations is that, and we see it every single time, is that societies that do not practice rational empathy, that do not have true equality, they end up collapsing because they either have conflict from within by oppressing their own people, or they have conflict by seeking out things from other civilizations. They try and take things from other people, and sooner or later you get into a fight that you don't win. And really, until we understand that, we're going to keep making the same mistakes over and over again. We're still making the same mistakes over and over again, and it will keep leading to the same outcome.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and Rob is with us from Duluth.
Yeah, hey, Chris. How's it going?
Good. How you doing?
Good. So I got a quick question for you. Do you think the NFL tries to maintain the image of the wholesome American game, and that when athletes like yourself and other athletes from other teams speak out, you know, against like gay marriage and other controversial things, do you think that they try to silence a little bit to maintain that wholesome image?
I think it's more to maintain the not so much wholesome image, but just sort of the broad spectrum appeal. But I think if they really sat down and thought about it, they would realize that, you know, gay people watch sports too. I was in a sports bar in San Francisco the other night for a book signing thing, and it's an entirely gay sports bar. And I mean, it's an entire segment of our population that the NFL hasn't tapped yet. And really, if you look at views of younger kids that are growing up now, they don't consider this an issue because they don't understand why it's an issue. And for them, it's, yeah, that's my friend, that's my teammate, that's my family member, and he or she happens to be gay. It's not a big deal. They're worried about things like the economy or endless wars. It's really, there are more important things that we have to deal with.
And thanks for the call, Rob. You know, athletes are role models. We all know that. I mean, not everybody acknowledges it, but they are. They carry a lot of influence. What would you think if more football players, more baseball players, more whatever players followed your lead and spoke out on more topics that they were passionate about?
I think it would be great because it would really help. It would help the leagues themselves with the image that, you know, generally most people think of athletes as knuckle-dragging troglodytes that, you know, can barely string sentences together. And like I said earlier, that's not the case. There are a lot of very smart guys. They just, you never hear about them. And so I think the more that athletes can be good role models and counterbalance the fact that we pretty much only hear about the negative side of what happens in sports, I think the more guys that can do that really will help people understand that, you know, sports is entertainment, but it can also be more than entertainment. And the fact is that we can't value it as entertainment over things that are important, like education and science.
Okay. You know, what are you thinking about working on now? I mean, you've got Sparkle Ponies under your belt. You've got the NFL career going on. Are we going to see more books from you, movies, more blogs? What?
Yeah. So I'm actually working on a science fiction trilogy with a friend of mine.
Are you kidding me or no?
No, I'm not.
This is true. Okay.
Yeah. So we finished up the first book. We're storyboarding the second one right now, and then we know where the third one's going to end up ending. And so that'll be something I'm working on. And then I don't know, whatever strikes my fancy, I'll try and do it.
And in the meantime, what's the reaction been to the book? You're doing book signings, you're doing publicity, you're getting some good feedback.
Yeah, it's been really good feedback. I've actually heard from a lot of people on Twitter, a bunch of teachers and professors saying, you know, I wish they would teach this in schools because the stories and lessons inside it they think would resonate really well with kids. Like that's pretty awesome to hear. And mainly just really good feedback from people saying, I didn't really know what to expect, but I'm really glad I read the book because it covers so much ground and deals with really interesting topics that it was a lot of fun to read, and it was also educational to read. And like I said before, it's not a football book. You know, this isn't the I'm telling my football story. There's like, I think, two football pieces in there, and then the rest of it is just all over the place because, like I said, it's kind of a snapshot into my mind.
Well, Chris, real quick, we've only got about 10 seconds, but what do your friends, your fellow athlete friends, think of your speaking out like this?
It's been very, very positive, very supportive. And I've had guys say, you know, I may not agree with you on same-sex rights, but we agree with you standing up for Brendan because that's a First Amendment issue. And I've had a lot of guys say we support everything you've done. We think you did a great job writing their letter.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. Chris Cluey is a punter for the National Football League. I think he's trying out for the Oakland Raiders right now. His new book is Beautifully Unique Sparkle Ponies.
Coming up next, we'll look at how the issue of race is affecting the George Zimmerman trial. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in this week for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll be talking about what's gone wrong with Kickstarter, the company that raises funds for creative projects through online crowdsourcing.
Our guest says Kickstarter is meant to fund interesting creative projects, but it's been corrupted by celebrities using it for their personal cash cow.
But first, we're talking about the role that race has played in the George Zimmerman trial. Zimmerman is charged with shooting 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The prosecution says the shooting was a racially charged homicide. The defense says the case is about self-defense by a concerned Neighborhood Watch volunteer.
Over the past 3 weeks, people following the trial have been talking about race, from the racial makeup of the jury to the code switching of a key witness.
And here to help break down this issue for us is Eugene Kane, contributor to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Eugene, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you along. I want to start out with just sort of your general impressions of this trial. You know, you've been around for a while. You've seen a lot of trials. And on the one hand, this one seems like a pretty simple question of murder. On the other hand, there's nothing simple about this trial at all.
Well, yeah, I have to admit my reaction from watching it on TV for the past couple weeks. It's been kind of frustrating because of my viewpoint that Trayvon Martin, the narrative has not changed from Trayvon Martin being basically an innocent young black teen who was trying to get home, who was being followed by pretty much a vigilante community watch person, and they had a confrontation, and after the confrontation, Trayvon is dead. I just don't feel the trial has been focusing as much on those basic facts as it has been dealing with a lot of other issues that I don't really, that I don't think are as relevant to the case. So it's been very frustrating. I do see the racial elements of it, but I don't really think race is the biggest thing if you just look at what the facts are. And a lot, and myself and a lot of other people are just concerned at how things are progressing, I'll say that.
So race is not the biggest thing, and the biggest thing is that this murder is getting lost in all of that?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that because, well, race is certainly part of this, the racial profiling that I think the trial evidence has shown took place, if only because the accused George Zimmerman is a guy who was known to call in suspicious black males, and that's all he called in. That night, there was a encounter that nobody really saw, but now all the focus on is on whose screams were heard on a 911 tape and who was on top and who wasn't on top. When the basics are that there were two people, one was armed, one wasn't armed. Trayvon Martin had made phone calls to a friend expressing his concern about being followed. So to me, if you take the gun away, it's an encounter between two guys who basically, if it just seems to me that if Trayvon Martin really did defend himself and there was a scuffle, without the fact that George Zimmerman was armed, he'd still be alive today.
Now, you've been pretty active tweeting in the I don't know what to call it, the Tweetiverse, or what we call that world where
Twitterverse, I think.
Twitterverse, there we go. You tweeted that this trial reflects the extreme fear that some white Americans have about angry black males. And could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I think a lot of the reaction I get, and first of all, most of the reaction I get are from African-Americans, but not exclusively African-Americans, but many of them mothers who or parents who see themselves as possible parents of a Trayvon Martin who goes out one night. And we just have to hammer home on the point that Trayvon Martin was an innocent. He was not a criminal. He was not a thug doing something wrong. George Zimmerman did not encounter him or confront him to keep him from breaking the law or anything. So my sense is that I just really do feel the way the trial has been going, it's just been very disconcerting to a lot of people that I know. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, you're getting to it. And I want to talk a little, sort of continue on in another column that you wrote a week or so ago. You talked a lot about the testimony of Trayvon Martin's friend, Rachel Jontel. And she was a witness, of course, for the prosecution, but her testimony was sort of confused sometimes. And, you know, sometimes it almost seemed confrontational. And I'm wondering how you think this may have impacted things.
Well, yeah, getting to the point where what this trial is showing is that a large amount of, I don't know the exact number, but many white Americans seem to feel because Trayvon was basically very aggressive that night, somehow this armed community watch person had the right to shoot and kill him when he felt his life was being threatened. And I just think that's the very racial element to me, because I wonder if Trayvon Martin wasn't a young black male, and if a lot of white people weren't convinced that, well, if I ever encountered a black young black male who seemed that he wanted to, you know, attack me, I would feel justified in shooting him too. And that's just so wrong-headed. It gets away from what the basic facts of this trial are. So that's why I do think the stand your ground rules in Florida, which aren't really in effect on this Zimmerman trial, but still, the sense that you can use self-defense, particularly if you're so freaked out by a young black male, I just, that's my reading on how it possibly has gotten to the point where every day Trayvon Martin is essentially on trial more than George Zimmerman is.
But that is also always the job of the defense, isn't it? To try to muddy the waters, to try to shed that doubt, to plant that seed.
Which is why I and others are so kind of agitated, angry, just annoyed with the way the prosecutors in Florida are handling this case. I mean, they have let Zimmerman basically present his case and focusing on things like the scuffle and who's on the tape yelling. And to me, they've gotten away from the whole idea that, again, this is an innocent young black man who did nothing wrong, who was confronted by the person who was following him. There was a scuffle, which you could almost say, if you put yourself in the head of Trayvon, who is a minor, he's 17 years old. He's being followed by an adult with a gun. How it gets to the point where now everybody's questioning whether Trayvon Martin did something so wrong that he deserved to die that night, it's confusing me. It's confusing a lot of my friends, many of whom are African-American, many who are not. That's where I'm seeing it now. As you can tell, I'm in a very agitated state about this Zimmerman trial at this point.
Well, I tell you, I don't think you're alone. We heard a few minutes ago news at the top of the hour that George Zimmerman is choosing not to testify.
Oh, yeah.
In his trial.
I predicted that.
Oh, you did? And tell me why.
Well, because, I mean, he really doesn't have to now. And on cross-examination, more would be brought out. Even the latest testimony of the struggle and who was on top and why, and whether or not Trayvon Martin was actually pulling away when Zimmerman shot him and killed him. I mean, I do understand why, from his point of view, Zimmerman, you know, he could hurt himself by testifying. I wish he would, but clearly they've decided not to do that.
We're going to wrap up here in a second, but before we do, one quick question. Does this trial have some legs in terms of its influence on and having a discussion on lending some clarity to these difficult subjects of race and crime and all of that? Are we going to see anything beyond the headlines come out of this?
Well, I think what will actually happen, particularly in Florida, is it'll be seen if, like I predict, that Zimmerman might be acquitted if he's not, if the jury isn't given the opportunity to perhaps convict him on a lesser charge of manslaughter, which I think now might have been the best way to charge him anyway. I do think the long-term effects will be that a lot of the citizens who fear young black males will somehow feel more justified in using deadly force to protect themselves after the fact. And I fear for that. I think that would be a terrible thing to happen.
Well, Eugene, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
That was Eugene Kane, contributor to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter from the Atlantic Wire about why he says Kickstarter has been corrupted by celebrities. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When all they've got is a personal credit card, Kickstarter has been a boon when it comes to funding meaningful personal projects for artists without name recognition or access to big-ticket donors.
But our next guest says the waters are getting muddy now that celebrities are using the platform to fund their personal projects. Artist and Kickstarter favorite Amanda Palmer, who recently made headlines for raising $1.2 million for her latest album, recently told us why fans who contribute to her work get something back.
I don't look at all at that act as them giving their money away. It doesn't feel at all like charity. It always feels like a very exciting two-way exchange where they pay me $5 and they get an album in return. And they get to feel like they have helped me do it, which they have. So it's, you know, in the crowdfunding sort of, you know, controversy that seems to be all over the place right now, especially with Zach Braff and right. Veronica Mars and all these filmmakers getting a lot of flack and, you know, big musicians getting flack for using crowdfunding. I think a lot of people are just missing the fundamental point, which is that crowdfunding has nothing to do with charity.
Musician Amanda Palmer defending her phenomenal success using Kickstarter to connect with her fans and fund her art.
Richard Lawson isn't so sure about Kickstarter when used by celebrities. He's a senior writer at the Atlantic Wire and takes issue with the celeb phenomenon. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Richard, what went through your mind as you're listening to Amanda Palmer talk there about her success using Kickstarter?
Well, I mean, I think that she's a kind of special case. I did find it kind of funny when she says, you know, that doesn't feel like charity. And, you know, I think probably to her it doesn't, but I think from kind of the outside looking in, it does seem like people are sending money sort of with no kind of accountability for how it's spent and just because someone asked for it. So it chafes a little, I guess.
Well, you've ruffled some feathers. First, when you wrote a piece about the Veronica Mars movie project. Now, this was a TV show. They wanted to turn it into a movie, and they turned mm-hmm. to Kickstarter. And Zach Braff also wanted to fund his next indie movie project. And both of those got under your skin a little. Can you tell us about why?
There was something to me that seemed a little, the word I used at the time was unseemly, about these wealthy, you know, established Hollywood people just sort of asking money for a product that has not been made, that we've not seen anything from. I suppose in the Veronica Mars case, we had the example of the show, obviously, to go on. But even then, you know, it's been a number of years since the show is on the air. We have no idea what this movie is going to look like. And the same thing for the Zach Braff project, whereas, you know, he obviously has fans from Garden State and other things. But you know, they're asking for upwards of $10,000 for something that no one's seen yet when they are all well-paid, TV and film stars.
Isn't it true of all Kickstarter projects, though, that you don't know what the end product is going to be? You don't know if you're going to contribute to something successful and your money will be well spent, or whether you're essentially just throwing it away. That's the nature of it.
No, it is. It's true. I mean, it's kind of a tricky thing. I think it's sort of a case-by-case basis. I mean, someone, you know, who wants to have funding for a month so they can go write, you know, their a book that's their passion project, you know, depending on the circumstances. Obviously, I think it's a great medium to raise funds for that. But when you do have this sort of looming kind of in the background specter of something like big studio Hollywood, I mean, you know, Warner Brothers is involved in the Veronica Mars movie, and Zach Braff recently got, you know, $10 million in funding for his movie when he was in Cannes. So I think that, you know, we have to look at what's behind it. If it really is just a private entity or a group of people just really wanting to make something and not having the money to do it, that's one thing. But when people are, you know, sending hard-earned money towards something where a huge, you know, companies are really rich, you know, concerns are going to profit, and they'll get is the movie that they just paid $100 to see, it sort of raises some questions for me.
We had a comment here. Holly on Facebook wrote about this, and she said, I actually donated to this project, and by that she's talking about Zach Braff's project.
Sure.
One of my all-time favorite films is Garden State, which was created largely in part by a private donation which allowed for a true depiction of the story by the artist. To ensure the opportunity to see another unpolluted film by Zach, I didn't hesitate to donate. So there's one person's take on why she did donate to that project. Do you think most people are thinking like Holly?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I wrote the initial post about the Veronica Mars Kickstarter, I got probably, 12 hours worth of, very vociferous feedback on Twitter and on the comments on the post. People really do feel passionate about this. And I don't think that they're being duped necessarily or anything like that. But, I think in the case of the Zach Braff movie, like your commenter said, I kind of don't really necessarily believe the narrative that Zach Braff, who had such huge success with Garden State and is now, he had a season's worth of television show, I don't really believe the narrative that there would be all this manipulation and meddling, especially when after the funds were raised on the Kickstarter, he went and got, private funding upwards of $10 million. So I think he probably had the independence to do it. To me, it read more as a kind of, honestly, like a kind of a PR move to do the Kickstarter campaign.
Sort of like a vanity project then?
Yes, and a way to sort of make it seem kind of cool and hip and of the moment, I guess.
Do you think any of the onus should be on Kickstarter itself here, that they should maybe put a cap on who's allowed to use it? Because idealistically, it should be for the little guy, I guess. And when we're seeing celebrities like Zach Braff, Veronica Mars, is there a problem with the way it's being used?
Well, I think that once you start to get into, Kickstarter itself policing any of that, I think, it gets territory, gets murky. How do you make those distinctions? I think that one big thing that Kickstarter could try to do, I don't know how they'd enforce it necessarily, but is the matter of accountability. I mean, and that's true of all Kickstarter projects, not just these big, celebrity ones. In terms of, we could hear in 6 months that the Veronica Mars movie is the production's been shut down. Same with the Braff, and then there's no sort of recourse for anyone who's donated. And on the other side of that, there's no accountability in terms of how the money is spent. And I think I know where Amanda Palmer had kind of run into some trouble when people found out that after raising $1 million, she was still asking local musicians to play her shows for free. So I think that if possible, Kickstarter could sort of set up rules for how the money is going to be spent and allocated and things like that.
So earlier you said Amanda Palmer was a special case. She's a well-known, in her own circles, musician. She's been in the New York Times for her success with Kickstarter. Why is she a special case?
Well, I think it was earlier in Kickstarter's life when she was involved in it, and I think that she kind of skirts that line between she was on a major label and arguably that's their kind of machine is what really put her, and I guess it was when she was in Dresden Dolls, sort of put her into the national spotlight, and she owes a lot to that. But she has obviously gone a more kind of independent route since then. I know where people take issue with her is that she gave a TED talk about asking for things and she has a story about a family sleeping in their living room so she and her band could use the bed and she's just saying that it's an exchange, like she said in that clip. And I think that she kind of does ignore also that like someone of her status sort of, was already at a certain level where she could ask and get anything in return. I think that I think it's a great system for people like her who have a certain level of notoriety, but I don't think that we can universally apply kind of her crowdfunding philosophy.
Well, even that notion of asking for things, mm-hmm. when someone is a little bit famous and they have that sparkly aura of money and fame about them, I think people are more inclined to give. Maybe there's a certain compulsion to it, even though you might not be aware of it.
Yes, I know. I think there definitely is. I mean, I think that I know that there are people who use Kickstarter almost like, just the website you go to every day to read, and they kind of scour and they find projects that they like and they fund them, and I think that's great. But yeah, obviously, when we saw the huge turnout for the Veronica Mars, just in the first day, it was millions of dollars already. Obviously they are they're benefited certainly by their fame, and I, you know, one or two things here and there is fine, but you know, the minute that that Veronica Mars's thing went big, you know, a week later, the actress Melissa Joan Hart had one trying to raise $2 million. She failed pretty significantly. So I guess at least there is some, you know, sort of natural selection going on. But, you know, and then Zach Braff jumped on it, and then James Franco had an Indiegogo campaign. You know, I just worry that it's going to get more and more and more, and all of a sudden it's going to be kind of de rigueur to pay $100 to see a movie that's not even been made yet.
Hmm. Well, one last question, as we've got about less than a minute to go here. You know, there's only so much money to go around. If we keep seeing these big celebrity projects, will the bottom just fall out at some point?
Well, I'd worry that the smaller stuff will completely disappear, and then you know, and it'll just be these massive kind of top tier things.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on it, and I'm betting you're going to keep writing about it.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Richard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Richard Lawson is a senior writer at the Atlantic Wire, and you'll find links to some of his pieces on the Central Time Facebook page. And let us know what you think. Should the rich and famous get to hold out their hats on Kickstarter? What have you chosen to fund or not to fund there? Let us know on Facebook.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get to know the ins and outs of a Scandinavian lawn game called Kube. It's a passion of Central Time producer Chris Molina's, and he'll give us a primer on the game as we get ready for the National Kube Tournament. That's coming up this weekend.
And we'll talk with the author of The End of Night, who says deep natural darkness is getting harder and harder to find in the era of light pollution run amok.
Also, we'll take a look at the obsessive nature of some of the world's top achievers.
Tomorrow on Central Time.